back to Hysteria Radio, the place to talk writing, music, expressive arts, brain health, and healing. Today, I have a very special guest. She's a good friend of mine who I met through the organization This Is My Brave. She is a singer, songwriter, and she's an amazing person. Her name is Danielle Fiorello Jones. Danielle, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, Joe, it's so good to be here, and I am doing great today. Today's a great day.
That's awesome. That's always good to hear. So I was talking to my friend Danielle last week because it was the 2-year anniversary of our This Is My Brave New York City show. And we thought, wouldn't it be a great idea to put together a podcast where we could talk about the experience of This Is My Brave itself and then the 2 years afterwards. So Danielle, why don't you give us a little bit of background? What is your experience with mental health?
All right. So I just want to say, you know, as a kid, I was basically a ray of sunshine. That's what I was called. I walked into a room and, you know, I just kind of lit it up. And, you know, I was just so happy and, you know, I just loved life. I wanted to be with everyone and everywhere. And I loved animals and people. And it was a wonderful childhood. I started writing songs at the age of 9 on the piano. My dad, he played piano, and he got that piano from his dad. My dad played by ear, and so he never sat down and, you know, had a sheet music in front of him, and he wrote songs. And so I grew up with my dad sitting in the living room at our piano, you know, just playing songs all the time and, you know, dancing around the house. And I just one day found out that I was able to do the same. And so we would write songs together and such. And dad was a banker to begin with, but then he actually moved in to New York City, where I'm not really sure how this happened, but at the age of 13, his dad was pretty invested in my music talents. He saw something in me, you know, that, and he was like, "Wow, you know, you're so young and you have this ability to do this." And when I look back now, actually, Dad, he refused to play out in public. And I believe now it's because he had anxiety, but he was never diagnosed. So I think it was the anxiety that really held him back from sharing his beautiful gift with the world. Wow. So he used to just sit in the living room and play. And, you know, he played for his family. He loved playing for his family, and he had a big family. He had there were 6 siblings altogether. So I, just on his side alone, had a very, very large extended family growing up, and it was wonderful.
Did he teach you how to play, or you just sat there and learned?
Yeah, he didn't teach me. I used to sit next to him on the piano bench, and I would just watch his hands, you know, glide over the keys. And one day I just thought to myself, like, well, let me see what happens if I were to sit down and try that. And, you know, it just kind of naturally happened. And they put me in, they gave me piano lessons. And that was interesting because I had, like, one of the best piano teachers. I absolutely loved her. I remember her name to this day was Bella. And I used to go, my mom would take me to her house, and, you know, she always would say to me, "Danielle, you're playing what is here in the book, but you're not looking at the book." Because I would do it one time, and then I would have it already, you know, in me, and I would just play it by ear, because I only needed to really hear something 1 or 2 times to be able to repeat it.
That's awesome. And
so what happened was my parents actually stopped getting me piano lessons because they felt it was a waste of money, because I wasn't actually learning anything that I needed to be learning as far as sight reading music and such, and, you know, learning music theory.
So you didn't even look at the book. You just went by what you heard. She plays something, or you'd play it once, and then that was it.
Yeah.
I never liked looking at the book either. I just wanted to hear it and play it too. So.
Yes, yes, and it just was natural. Yeah, I hated looking at the book, hated it. So so no more piano lessons for me, which I was actually quite happy with because I found it boring because I was like, but I know how to play this.
That's funny. All piano players love playing the piano, but none of them liked lessons.
Yeah, how funny is that? I mean, I think now maybe that I'm a little more disciplined, I could probably do better with lessons. But at the time, I was just like, no, let me run free, you know? So just basically that's how that started. And when I was, then I just would sing all the time. I was always singing something. Dad listened a lot to Celine Dion and Mariah Carey was like my girl growing up. Like I had a poster of hers in my bed. So when I was 13, my dad decided that I don't even know how this happened still to this day. We were going to make me a demo tape, right? A cassette tape. That's when there was cassette tapes now.
Yeah, I remember those days, yep.
And we went into a studio, and I recorded 3 songs on there. Not my own songs, just covers. One was a Bette Midler song, one was a Mariah Carey song, and the other song was Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And me and Dorothy have a very tight bond. I've also done a lot of theater, grew up doing theater and singing in church and everywhere. I was always doing some kind of performing. Uh-huh. So when I was 13, we did that demo tape and my dad met a guy at another building, in New York. He worked on Madison Avenue and his friend worked in the lobby of the Sony building, where Tommy Mottola's office was. And my dad thought, well, let me just see if I could ask my friend if he could get this demo tape up to Tommy Mottola's office. And I don't know still, like I said, how he did it, but he got my demo tape up to Tommy Mottola's office from Sony. And Tommy Mottola was quite impressed with the fact that I was 13 years old and singing Mariah Carey.
So he listened to it.
And singing it very well, yeah. So he actually then was like, well, my dad, I think, wrote like a little thing that went along with the tape and saying, you know, my daughter also, plays piano and writes songs on her own and, you know, and she really loves doing that as well. And so he said, well, I'd love to hear some of her original stuff. So we were in the middle of finishing writing some songs up to get recorded on a demo tape to give back to Tommy Mottola. And my dad, he passed away just suddenly, without any warning. He had a massive heart attack. And at the time, there was also a lot of family issues going on. My parents were in the middle of a divorce. My older brother had been sent away to Florida due to drug addiction and mental health issues. He had tried to kill himself, and thank goodness that his friend had come to the house and taken him to the hospital, or he would not be here today. And that situation, I had come home from school and I saw my brother was not right, but I didn't know that he was trying to kill himself. He had taken my father's pills and drank a lot of alcohol with him. My dad was an epileptic.
How old were you at this time?
I was 14. I was around 13, 14.
Wow.
So, and prior to that, my older brother was, having a lot of issues a lot of behavioral stuff. My mom wound up having to homeschool him. He just was not okay in any type of way through childhood. So it was a little tough on the family, you know, having having a sibling and a, you know, a child that, you know, no one could really figure out what were the issues and how to fix them, you know, how to help him.
Definitely.
So, yeah, so it, so there was that. And then, so, you know, not only did brother get sent away, but then my parents had gotten divorced. I have a younger brother, and at the time the courts had left it up to the children because we were old enough to choose where we wanted to live. I stayed with my dad, and my younger brother went with my mom to an apartment down the road. That was still, you know, very hard on the family because, you know, now me and one of my best friends were separated, you know, being my brother.
Yeah.
And then about 4 months, it was 4.5 months after the divorce and after them moving out that my dad died. So everything happened so very quickly in a short amount of time, you know, just one after another.
So what's going on? I mean, you're 14 years old. Like, what's, do you even remember what's going on in your head, or is it just too much to even comprehend at that time?
Yeah, it was just kind of too much. The part of the biggest part of this situation and the part of this story of mine is that I found my father dead in my downstairs bathroom. Oh. I was 15 at the time, because like I said, there was that whole year that happened where, you know, the divorce was going on, and, you know, my brother was, you know, sent to Florida and all that. But I was 15 and I was about to turn 16. My dad was actually planning my sweet 16 party. He died November 9th and I was born January 15th. So right after he died, then was my sweet 16 party. I didn't get to dance with my dad for my father-daughter dance, and that was very difficult. I danced with my older brother, stood in his place, which was very awesome, and I have, you know, a beautiful photo album with pictures of everything. As heartbreaking as that was at the time, I mean, I had an awesome family, you know, surrounding me, and great friends, and the school was really, really good with us. You know, the high school we went to, I went to Edison High School. That's where I grew up.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it was, you know, they had a, one of the teachers that ran a grief group. I will love bringing this up because, I have to say that if I didn't have that, honestly, like, I don't know how I would have gotten through the rest of high school or even at least that year. And so what we would do is every week, I think it was two times a week, third period, in the mornings, we had a grief group with, Mr. Sean, and, we would just sit and we could talk about whatever it was that we wanted to talk about, if we didn't want to talk about it. But he also shared ways with us that, you know, to help us deal with the loss, that we were feeling. So, and I remember, one thing that really helped me too, and I think everyone has their own little things, and I don't mind sharing mine. Sometimes it seems silly in my head, but I had a picture of my dad. It was like a wallet size picture, and I taped it every single morning before I went to school. I taped that picture over my heart under my shirt.
Wow.
And I wore that picture there every day for like a year. You know, just because I needed to feel some kind of tangible, like, you're with me still.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how I dealt with that. Well, one of the ways, another one of the ways that I dealt with, basically I went into shock for a year. At the wake, I remember, I was consoling people at my father's wake. And people were looking at me and they were like, oh my gosh, like, you know, like, Danielle, like, you're smiling and comforting us. And like, you're the one that's gone through that. And I was like, it's okay. Like, this is what dad would have wanted to do.
Feel like you almost had to, like, yeah, I was going to say, did you feel like you had to, like, take his place almost, you know, and be the strong one at that point?
Yeah. I want to be as though Dad would want me to be, you know, in his honor. So, I mean, I purposely wore the day of his wake, I wore a pink lace dress. And then the day of the funeral, I wore my white lace dress. Cause I was like, Mom, I don't have to wear black, do I? And she was like, honey, you can wear whatever you want. And I said, okay, thank you. And I said, well, I'm wearing my white lace dress then, because I refuse to wear black, because that is dark and depressing. And I don't think Dad would want me to wear black. And she said, okay, that's fine. So, and that's what I did. And, you know, I think everyone was very shocked by that even, because, yeah. Yeah. You know, they expect you to be just so, you know, just so absolutely distraught, and not that I wasn't, I just needed some kind of bright in a very, very dark situation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's, I think, something that I was born with. That's kind of innate in me, because I see that now even still.
A tremendous amount of pressure to have, you know, for somebody who's in high school. That's, can't even imagine that much pressure.
Yeah, it was rough. I almost didn't graduate high school. I didn't get to walk at my graduation. That's a whole other story. But I mean, like I said, the shock was for about a year. Mm-hmm. I really just kind of went on autopilot, you know, and I made really bad decisions. I acted out a lot. When I was 16, I started drinking a lot. I started sneaking out of my window and climbing down the roof and the tree and just going out. Even on school nights, I would go like meet my friends or whatever. Yeah. I would go meet guys and, you know, hook up. I was just acting out terribly.
But you didn't make bad decisions. You did what a lot of teens do. So, you know, don't beat yourself up over that. I mean, I could go through war stories with you about bad decisions, but I mean, in reality, you were just being a teenage girl and you had a tremendous amount of pressure and stress on you already. So maybe you were doing that not to act out, but because you needed some relief.
Yes, definitely. Definitely needed some kind of relief and didn't know really where to turn. I mean, they put me on, I got put on Zoloft, and I got put in, therapy right away. And I went to group therapy during the summers. I would go to an outpatient, you know, summer program where I would go to group every day. Every single day of the week for like 6 hours of just talking about, you know, all the bad stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, which can be overwhelming, you know, but also helpful, So between that, you know, between Mr. Sean, you know, doing the grief group at school, you know, and having the therapy and the group therapy, I think that was really important that, you know, I was, I don't want to say pushed, but I mean that I was encouraged and stuff to do that. And I really, really, really am a big, big, big advocate for therapy, especially after some kind of a trauma like that. Yeah. I don't care what age you are, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, any kind of trauma, you know, go and get some guidance with, you know, how to navigate through processing it, because
No, that's how I feel. A lot of people are either against therapy or they just don't think that they need it. And I see people who have gone and have gotten better and then they stop going and then like the rails start coming off. And for me, I look at therapy as like, you know, it's almost like bumpers in my bowling lane. Like it keeps me, it keeps me from, you know, going over the edge in either way. And it kind of reels me back in at the end of every month. And, you know, it's like a check-in, and it's actually I get to go to somebody every month that gives me tips on how to better my life. And like, how can it get any better than that? You know, and
exactly.
It took me a while to get there. For a while, I thought it was like work and I thought it was BS and, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. They're just trying to psychoanalyze me. But if you find the right person, you know, this guy's given me $1 million, you know, worth of good information every month. So
yep.
It's highly worth it.
I absolutely agree. I mean, my therapist that I have now, she actually, like, she's cried before, like, with me. Like, she's, you know, where she's just been like, oh, you know, you just see her eyes well up with tears. And, like, you feel the compassion in her. And you feel, you know, that, like, she wants to help you, you know, like, she knows she's been somewhere and she knows that it's possible, you know, to live a healthy, functioning, you know, lifestyle, you know, despite having been diagnosed with mental illness. And like, that's really where it is at for me, you know, nowadays, you know, is, hey, so what I mean, I have this thing, but, you know, I can still live with it, right? Like, it's okay. Like, we can function with help, of course, but, you know, and yeah, it took me a little while to get into the therapy too. You know, but I kind of equate it to dog training, cause I'm into animals too. I love, love, love animals. Yes. I work with animals it's like the consistency. That's basically what it's about. I mean, if you're consistent in something, I mean, you would be really surprised how quickly it actually starts to change over into what you want it to be, you know, whatever the behavior is.
Exactly. I say that all the time, that practice, you don't just need practice in sports and music. You need to practice like life. You need to practice. Thank you for mental health. I know you have to practice thought. Like for me, I'll use like affirmations or meditation, or like I had to reintroduce myself to positivity because I'd lost it for so long. I'd lost it for years. I forgot how to be positive. I forgot how to be happy. I forgot how to have fun. And, you know, these are all things that you need to learn how to do again. You know, just how someone who hurts their leg or their hip has to learn to walk again. You know, it's the same thing when you have a brain injury or a mental illness, you know, whatever you want to call it, whatever anybody's calling it. Like, let's be real. It's an illness and you have to come back from it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, you know, take the pill and you're there, or, you know, go in the hospital for a month and you're there. Like, you need to put time and energy and practice into recovery. And then it starts to work.
That's right. And, you know, I would like to actually bring to light a great example is my mother. She just had a major, major abdominal surgery. Okay. Like, the doctors were like, wow, you really were not okay. And like, things were a mess in there. It was a very, very serious. I mean, if stuff hadn't started happening the way it happened, like she could have died. It was that serious. And she goes through that. She was in the hospital for, I believe, 12 days. And, you know, and so they cut her open from side to side, everything, you know, they had to do a whole bunch of stuff. They had to get a re-corrective surgeon in there, you know, to help close her up and everything. So, you know, then they were telling her, you know, these are the things that you need to do, you know, that are up to you now when you go home and leave the hospital. These are the things that you need to do to keep up with your recovery and make sure that your body heals properly and you're not pushing things too much or you're not, you know, slipping back into this and that. And I'm thinking, you know, wow, I mean, it is the same thing with mental health. And if we could just get everybody on the same page, like it's the same thing. I mean, and my mom, because she listened, you know, because she took care of herself and she followed the, you know, these suggestions and stuff from her doctors and telling her, you know, what she needed to do diet-wise and whatnot. Guess what? Her recovery has been going so well that they're shocked. They're like, wow, you were such a mess. Like, we're surprised how well and how quickly you're healing and recovering. And, you know, and I really, I attribute that to her, you know, doing self-care and taking care of it and really, you know, listening.
That's
to
it.
The people that want to help her recover well, you know. So it's really up to us. And I love the fact that they said to her, you know, it's up to you when you go home to do these things.
Right.
Because, you know, they're like, we're not going to be here anymore. You know, you're not going to have, you know, we'll send a nurse, you know, a couple days a week that's going to check on you for the first couple, 2 weeks, you know, just to make sure that you're okay. And if you have any concerns, then someone can come to your house. Because it was such a major surgery. But other than that, right, like it's up to you to make sure you're keeping up with your health and your recovery. So, you know, I feel like, yes, mental illness sucks, right? And it's frustrating and we get to places where we just feel like we can't. But the thing that I've learned just through my own experience with getting better each day is that it's the times when I feel the absolute worst that I have to put action. Action yeah. has to happen, yes. no matter, like, and that's the hardest part. I'm going to tell you right now. I have screamed and cried and kicked and thrown tantrums. You know what I'm saying? I know you can.
So I have kicked and screamed. 34-year-old man kicked and screamed and thrown tantrums.
I mean, yes. Where I've had times I've thrown myself down on the ground. I've just been like, I can't do this, you know. But then I get up and I got to go do something. I mean, because when I don't, that is when even just a day sometimes by just laying down and not taking action, that day can turn into 2 days. And then those 2 days can turn into five. And then those five can easily turn into 10. And then before I know it, guess what? I'm 2 months down the road, have sat on my couch and done nothing.
And now I'm in the hospital at that point, you know, that's, or I'm borderline ready to go to the hospital if I've sat around for more than 2 months, because I'm way too in my own head and not in touch with the real world and what's really going on. And I know all about that. So take me back to when you know, you were struggling, you finished up with high school, and then what happened after that?
Well, I was in a band with one of my best friends and his mom and a guy that played the guitar, and it was awesome because, you know, we were going around playing gigs at like different bars and whatnot. But of course, it really wasn't the best scene for me to really be involved in. You know, there was, like I said, a lot of drinking, you know, and such. And here's the part that really always blows my mind is when I, up until the age of like, you know, 15, I was very, very, if anyone even mentioned like any specific illegal substance, you know, a drug, any kind of name of a drug. If a kid was talking about a drug, I would not even associate with that person because I didn't, you know, not because of any kind of judgment, but because I didn't, something inside of me made me feel uncomfortable and I didn't want to get pulled into that type of lifestyle.
Yeah.
So at a very young age, I was very aware of, you know, and I like right from wrong for me was, you know, you're not going to do drugs. Like that's not an option. You know what I mean? So when for me to have gone down the road that I went is so profound, and people need to hear this because it made me realize you never say never, ever, ever. You never say never because you never know where one day you might wind up. There might be one moment, and that moment changes the rest of your life. And that's what happened to me. I said I will never do drugs, never. And then there I was one day, and I was so depressed. I was, you know, my mood was all over the place. Like I said, I had been drinking very heavily with my friends and my band. You know, we were always together drinking. Oh. Every time we went out, we would drink. So one day I'm hanging out with a guitar player and I just was so depressed. I didn't know what to do with myself. And now, mind you, when I was 16, I actually had my first suicide attempt. it was an attempt that was, I'm going to take a lot of these Tylenol PMs. And I thought that because they were sleeping pills, that they would make me go to sleep forever.
Yeah.
So I just took, you know, I mean, really all that did was I just slept a lot. You know, I slept for a long time. And no one ever knew about that. I never told anybody about that.
I had a couple attempts like that with benzos where I just slept a lot.
Right. You're just like, okay, well, maybe I won't wake up.
Yeah, what I thought was going to happen. And you know what? Honestly, looking back, I'm glad I woke up, and I'm glad I took the wrong thing. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Me too. I mean, and
I felt like an idiot at the time. I felt like, right. I was like, man, I can't even do this right.
But, I know, right? I'm a failure. I've had that thought for sure. I mean, it's so good that, you know, we can laugh about this now. And I know it's not a joking matter.
I know people,
but it is. It's so silly when you're like, oh my gosh, like I felt like a failure because I couldn't even take myself out.
Yeah. From a right state of mind. It's unbelievable that we were in a state at one time where you could think like that. But
exactly. You know,
I think it's worth noting when somebody on the outside who doesn't understand that laughs, like I used to get upset about it. But I think it almost like humanizes us, and you know. I think being able to laugh about it now is a good thing, rather than getting defensive and angry about it now.
Oh yeah.
Because we are the ones that struggled, so right. So like we deserve to smile now. Like.
Amen to that.
Yeah.
I love that. We're the ones that struggled, so it's okay for us to laugh. Yeah. Yes, I love that.
And so, other people, I think, as long as they're not like degrading you, you know, like,
they're laughing with you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's safe to say, because a lot of people nowadays, especially on social media, like jump down each other's throat. Like, I see a lot of like, don't say commit suicide, don't say, you know, mental illness, say, you know, psychological condition, or, you know, and it's just like, you know what? 5 years ago, no one was saying anything. So the way I look at it is, as long as we're talking about it, let's just talk about it. And then later you can educate the person on what word to use. But at least at least we're talking about it.
Yep. Absolutely. I love that. You're amazing.
You're the best. Finish what you were saying. I'm sorry.
I just want to, because this is important. This is a kind of important part of my story.
Okay.
I was just sitting there one day, so depressed, out of my head. And what did I do? And then my friend, I was like, this is my friend. And he's like, you know, trying to offer, you know, well, you want to go see a movie? Maybe you want to go bowling? Do you want to go out and get some pizza? And I just kept saying no, no, no to everything. And we had been drinking. And then he was just like, well, here, have some of this, and offered me cocaine. And that was it.
Yeah.
It changed the rest of my life. And so, I mean, I went from in and out. After that, I went in and out of rehab. I was homeless a few times, living on the streets in Florida. I lived at a Greyhound bus station, it was really bad. And my mental illness was then, of course, really out of control. At that point, I had been diagnosed bipolar right before I went into my first rehab, and with underlying depression and then anxiety disorder and PTSD from when I found my dad in the bathroom. I kept having very bad flashbacks of that day. So in and out for years and years and years. I would come home, you know, my mom would let me come home, and then she would wake up one day and I would be gone, and she wouldn't know where I was. And she finally, you know, I would collect, call my family and ask for money, you know, can you wire me money? And she finally said, no more. And I'll tell you, you know, this I always tell everybody, like, this partly saved my life. When my mom told me no, I didn't have anyone else to go to anymore. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I was like, she was not enabling me anymore to keep going back and forth and doing this behavior. And so I was really, really on my own. And then I was scared and I was like, oh my God. So I just went back to the rehab and with my hands up and I surrendered. And I was like, you know what? Please just, okay, I give up. Like, I really do. Just take me. And they did. They let me back in. And I stayed there for a very long time. It was a very long time. I had a very serious suicide attempt, which that one I really almost didn't wake up from. I pretty much died. My heart stopped. I was in the ICU.
This was after your rehab?
Yes, this was after rehab.
Absolutely. How long were you in rehab for?
I went to two different rehabs. The first one was, I was in there for like 40 days. And the second one, I went to like their, it was, I was there like a year and a half on their property. They had like different levels that you would go through. So you would come in and do the first level and then you would kind of graduate from there. And then you could get like a part-time job and, you know, and start like paying like a little bit of a weekly rent so that, you know, to start integrating you back into, you know, the social life, you know, with working and stuff like that. So they helped me to, you know, get back in to that. But I did well for like about 8 years. You know, the one thing that really always messed me up was relationships. I just always felt the need to be with somebody. And by doing that, you know, it kind of really didn't matter who I hooked myself up with, you know, like, so, I mean, it was very unhealthy, you know, a lot of abuse, you know, things like that. So my relationships, you know, were never really very good. And the last person that I, not the second to last person I was with was, I mean, we almost killed each other. She's who I was with when I tried to kill myself down by the Delaware River. Now that was about like 7 years ago. I survived and I was actually I went up to the hospitals. I went from ICU. When I woke up, I went up to the psychiatric unit on the hospital, in the hospital, and I was there for 2 weeks. And then they sent me to the state hospital where I was committed because I couldn't let go of the anger that I felt for still being alive. And that is... They were like, okay, well, because you're still angry that you're here, we can't let you go. You know, we have to commit you because you're a danger to yourself.
I've been there.
Yeah, so that's basically how that went. And, you know, and it was quite an experience, I have to say. But, you know, when you're a drug addict, your manipulation skills are, like, off the charts. I mean... You know, and that's, I'm not saying that as a good thing. I mean, it's really, but it's, addicts are extremely intelligent, extremely intelligent. And I was able to manipulate the people there at the state hospital, and they let me go within a month. They were like, there's nothing wrong with her. Like, she's completely normal. Like, because I knew how to act. Wow. I knew what to say. I knew it all. I did everything they asked me to do when they asked me to do it. You know, they let me go after a month. And then a month later, I was back doing drugs.
Yeah.
And, you know, things got really bad again.
Yeah, I always kind of wondered about that because there were times that I was probably at my absolute worst that I would go, somebody would bring me to intake, either family or they'd call the police and somebody would bring me to intake and I'd go in and I'd be out in an hour. And then there were other times where I felt like I wasn't that bad, and then they'd keep me in there for 45 days. I really couldn't.
Yeah, right? What is that about?
I mean, looking back, I was probably in bad shape every time I went there. But, you know, at the time, you know, I'd get out after that hour, and I'd be like, oh, I got him again. But I guess I really only got myself.
You know, so. Yep. And right. And that's, yes, looking back, it was, yes, it was like, wow. I mean, well, what help were you really giving yourself by doing that? Well, none. You just didn't want to be in the hospital, because who wants to be in the hospital, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, but I had gotten, because I had been in many hospitals, and so I also had gotten very good at learning the ropes and how everything goes and, you know, what you should and shouldn't say, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. So that was that. But yeah, I, you know, there was a man that found me, he found me, laying in the road. And he called 911, and that's how, ultimately, I mean, that's, I guess that's how my life was saved. I think that, because before I got to him, I don't know how I got to him, because number one, I was not aware or awake or conscious in any way, shape, or form. And the place that I had gone to was a very, very, very steep hill that I had climbed down to get to by the river. So how I got up there, I mean, obviously I walked, but that wasn't me carrying myself, is what I'm saying. You know, something untied me from the tree, and something carried me up there, and, you know, and got me close enough to where then when I collapsed, you know, the man saw me and was able to call for help. I'm very fortunate to not have any, you know, really extreme percussions as far as, you know, health-wise from that situation.
Yeah.
I mean, my brain, you know, I've had many doctors tell me, you know, your brain is actually still healing, and it takes the brain a very long time for it to heal. So, you know, you got to give yourself you know, years. You have to give yourself years for your brain to heal. You know, when I was told that, though, I felt that was comforting, because I, you know, you get frustrated and sometimes, and I feel like it's like we're pretty much all of like the instant gratification, right? We want it now. We want to feel better now,
yep.
Right? but I feel better. I want to feel better now, but it's like, you know, that's not reality. And when I started to embrace that like it's nothing really is right now. You're not going to feel better right now in 1 second, and it's going to take a little bit of time. When I started embracing that more, I think then things got a little bit easier to, you know, during, you know, my healing process.
Right.
So yeah, so, that's pretty much where my awful story ends.
So that's, yeah, that's then, where, okay, so.
And then we pick up with a meeting, you know, coming back home. You know, I lived in Florida for a long time. I lived in Virginia for a little bit with my ex. And then that was just not a good situation, and that had to end. So then I came back home, and my mom took me in.
Okay. So after all this, now you're hanging out. You've had a really, really rough go for the last at least like 15 years or so. And now you find out about This Is My Brave, or This Is My Brave finds out about you. How did that happen?
Well, this is actually one of my favorite parts. Is I met a girl, her name was Denise. And so we started dating, then I moved in. I was still going through kind of a tough time with my depression and my anxiety, and I was finding it very hard to go outside. I was living with her at that time for 2 years, and I basically just stayed in the house. Like, I really didn't go anywhere. And I just
I got into that, and it was bad. Well, one day, Denise was on the computer, and I was on the computer, and I was scrolling through Facebook, and I had liked this page called National Bipolar Foundation that I'd been following, and so I see this post that says, "This is my brave. Are you a writer, you know, a poet or a musician, you know, that, you know, has mental illness and would like to share your story?" And I was like, well, that pretty much describes me, right? I was like, okay. I write songs and I have mental illness. So, But because of the amount of how deep I was in my anxiety disorder, I didn't really entertain the idea of actually doing that. I was like, well, that sounds great. I was like, and I'm glad that that's out there. And it kept still like kind of, you know, taunting me.
Yeah.
And I had mentioned it to Denise when she got home from work that day. And I was like, hey, I found this thing. I was like, what do you think? And she was like, you know, I really think you should, maybe you should do it. Maybe you should try out. And I was like, I don't know. So I didn't, because it said register underneath. It says send your, you know, to get an audition slot, you know, please send us a message at blah blah blah. And so I never did it. I never did it. And I think it was like a week and a half went by, right?
Uh-huh.
And I told Denise she said, she kept asking me about it. She's like, when do you have to have the, you know, send your sing in by for that? This is my brave. And I was like, I don't know. I think it's this date. And so she went on the computer with me sitting there watching her, and she filled out the form for me and sent it in.
Wow.
And she said, this is something you need to do. I just know it. You need to do this.
Oh, she's the
best. And I was like, all right, fine. I guess I'll do it. And because I really was, not going to fill that thing out by myself. I can tell you that right now. It wasn't going to happen. I was going to let that opportunity pass me by.
Wow. So you almost weren't there.
Yes, I was almost not there.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. What would I do right now?
Lost my side, Jew, right? Yeah, I know. Yeah. What would we do? We wouldn't have this. I mean,
So then you found out you got an audition.
Yep. So they wrote back and they said, this is your audition day and time. And, you know, and Sydney said, okay, this is it. It's on my calendar. She said, I'll make sure I tell work that I'm not going to be there that day, and we're taking it in the city. And and I was like freaking out because I was like, oh my God, I haven't been in the city in so long, and like, it's too much. And I haven't even been out of my house in like 2 years, and you're going to take me to New York. Like, what's wrong with you?
I honestly thought, and I'm going to be perfectly honest, and I love This Is My Brave, and I love the whole process, but there were a couple points where I was like, is this going to drive me back into like anxiety or mania again? Because, and it had nothing to do with the people or This Is My Brave, but I was so scared to come out and tell people, you know, publicly that I had mental illness, because it was something that I could barely even talk about or didn't talk about at the dinner table or closest friends. It would come up every once in a while, and then they'd ask me like one simple question, and I'd go on like a 2-hour rant about it, because I was like all they needed to do was like give me the opportunity to start talking about mental illness, and I wouldn't stop. But then I think like it wouldn't get brought up again for another 6 months, because it was like, whoa, we don't want Joe like going off on one of those 2-hour you know, education pieces on mental health again.
Right. But,
yeah, it was really stressful. Like auditions, I was shaking the whole way going down to the city. I drove, you know, from where I live, and it was like 45-minute to an hour ride, and I was shaking the whole way down. So what did you took the train up?
Yeah, we took the train. My mom came too, which you know, which was nice to have her there too. I mean, she was excited for me, and they were excited for me. But I was like, I'm glad you guys are all excited, because I'm like about to shit my pants.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Language.
Yeah.
But, my tummy was all a mess and everything. I was sweating. I was soaked. I was soaking wet when I got into the room. And then I was even more soaking wet when I left the room. I was just like, oh, what did I just do? You know, but, you know, it was, I mean, we thank God for them, really. Thank everything that I, that all, everything I have in my life for them, you know, helping me to get there. Because it, without them, I honestly, on my own, I wouldn't have done it. I just know it. My self-sabotage at that point was so strong, and I didn't realize it. I didn't realize it was self-sabotaging behaviors, you know, that I was exhibiting.
I just needed somebody to tell me that it was okay to be who I was. You know, everybody... Yeah. Everybody was trying, and I give them credit, you know, family and friends, like they were trying to hook me up with people they knew for like a job here and there, or find me, you know, a school that I could get into and learn. So, but I was like, you guys really don't get it. Like with this illness, I need to be doing what I love to do. And there's a reason, you know, I love this so much. I hate to say this, but I feel like this is my Brave validated what I was doing. And I feel like I shouldn't have needed This Is My Brave to validate me. But once I got involved with them and people saw their website and people saw that they had done other shows before and people saw that this was a real thing, then all of my ideas became real possibilities to everybody else. And it wasn't just something. Illusion I was having in my room that I could write poetry and talk about mental illness and mental health the rest of my life. And like you said, I really owe everything that I do right now. Everything I do is related to mental health and writing. And Jen and This Is My Brave and our producers and our cast and everybody at that show like made it possible for me to be here, what I'm doing right now.
Yep, I feel the same exact way. I couldn't have said it better, honestly. It changed my life. It really did. And it's funny to, you know, talk about and reminisce about the process of going through it and starting out and how scared and awful and sick we felt, you know, and now we're just like, hey, we're so brave now. Look at us. We're going out and doing all these awesome things, you know, like,
yeah.
It gives me, I, if you saw me right now, you would see, I have goosebumps all over my face.
I get it every day. That's why this is the best job in the world, because, it's just amazing. But, so let's talk about, rehearsal.
Yeah.
We all finally met.
Yeah, so we all met, and I instantly was just, I was drawn to everyone. I was just like, wow, like, this is a great group of people, you know?
Yeah.
Being able to sit there, just us in such an intimate setting and listen to each other's pieces for the first time was really, wow, one of the most incredibly moving things that I had ever been a part of.
That was a powerful day.
Oh my God. I'm tearing up right now and I have goosebumps everywhere. I get emotional, but because I was like, oh my gosh, like I can't even describe what it felt like to be in the presence of everyone, you know, in that room that day. It was just so incredible. It was, wow, something. I just felt so special, you know, and in a way that I had never felt special before, you know. I felt part of something. And, you know, there's a song that I grew up listening to by an artist called Michael W. Smith. He's actually a Christian artist. I grew up in a Christian church, born-again Christian. I'm non-denominational now. I kind of just do like my spiritual, you know, journey. But I love to take from all different teachings, because actually a lot of them I find are really very similar, just kind of in different wording.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they all have the same message behind them. You know, one of them, one of the biggest ones being love. Let's just love one another.
Yeah.
But this guy, he, and actually, if you go on my Facebook, I think it says underneath my picture, I think it says looking for a reason, roaming through the night to find my place in this world. So there was this song that Michael W. Smith sang called Place in This World. And that line, and that song always just like was so deep in me, because for the longest time, I just never felt like I found my place in the world. I didn't know where I was supposed to be, where I fit in, where, you know what I mean? Like I didn't have that. And sitting in that room that day, I was like, oh my gosh, my place in this world.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is, like, I have found my place in this world, and being a part of that really led me to finding, becoming more clear. I want to say becoming more clear on what my purpose is in this world, so that then I could give it away. So, because for a long time, I'm like, I know I have to have a purpose. Like, everyone has a purpose, right? And when you feel like you don't have a purpose, for me personally, when I, all the years I didn't feel like I had a purpose were the years that I was the most depressed, was the most anxious, you know, struggled the most with my mental health, because I just didn't feel like I had anything to live for. You know, then my thoughts would go to, well, then why are you even here? Then what do you have to live for? You don't even have a purpose. You're just wasting, you know, air. You're taking up space for somebody else, you know, that has a purpose, that could be using their purpose. So this is literally where my mind, my thoughts would be. Like,
yeah. No, I hear you.
Every single day.
I mean, I just think about other jobs and people would be like, why don't you go do this? Or why don't you go do this? And I'd be like, because there's 100 million other people doing that. They don't need me, you know? And that was always my, and people did not understand that. They're like, listen, man, you'll make, you know, you'll start out at 75 grand a year. You'll have benefits. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't get it. Like, I can't just show up somewhere just to be there. You know, I need to be thinking about my job, unfortunately, like every hour that I'm awake, and how I could improve it and how I could relate it to the life that I've lived and how I can help others. And all these different things need to mix in order for me to feel comfortable, where most other people just want, like, you know, a salary and a place to show up every day, 9 to 5. You know, I need so many other things to feel satisfied and content. And I totally get it.
I actually speak about that a lot to people that, you know, I try to help, you know. I talk a lot about that, and my experience with, you know, not just throwing my, and trust me, I tried many, many different jobs, like, you know what I mean? Like, just to at least be trying to do something and be productive. That didn't work for me. That actually triggered me more. It would trigger my anxiety more. It would trigger my depression more. I would call out a lot from work, you know, like, from getting sick to my stomach, you know? Now, you're right. Like, when you find stuff that you're, when you're doing something you're passionate about, it's just a whole different ballgame. Yeah. You know, there really is no work. I mean, yeah, there's work, and there's things that, you know, there's going to be stressful times, right? Because, I mean, that's just life. I mean, things happen. But, you know, you deal with them because, and you move on because you're like, this is the work that I love to do.
Yes.
You know, so yes. I want to be the best.
Could not have said that better.
I'm totally there. I feel that I have some, you know, found definitely more clear on what my place is in this world, you know, and what I'm, and I'm finding more and more as I go on what I'm able to give, you know, to someone individually or to the world as a whole. Because we all have something to give, and it's important that we go on the journey to find out what that is. You know, that's what I really believe. And
absolutely.
I consciously made a decision to go on a journey of self-discovery. And it wasn't easy. It definitely has not been easy. And to make that decision was a tough one. Because I knew that would mean, you know, sacrificing things that maybe I didn't necessarily want to. That meant that I was going to be, you know, changing and growing and having growing pains and, you know, wanting to give up. And, you know, and I knew all that, but I still went ahead and chose to do it anyway and stuck with it. And I'm glad that I did.
They say that getting mental illness is not a choice, but they say recovery is absolutely 100% a choice. And by too often we label it recovery when it's really just, like you said, self-discovery and finding yourself and following your passion and loving life. You know, isn't that what we're missing with the mental illness? Is we've lost like this love and this, you know, cliche zest for life.
Yeah.
But you lose that, and you really need to make a choice to do everything in your power to get that feeling again. Because for me, that's the only reason to be here is to feel good every day.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in agreement with that.
So since the show, now we do the show. Oh, at first, actually, I want to talk about what you did at the show, because I was having a rough day the day of the show. And I don't mean it like a bad day, but I was anxious. I was really anxious. I don't even really remember the 5 or 6 people that went before me in the show, because I was replaying my poem in my head while everybody else went, because I was afraid that I was going to lose it or forget it while that person was going in front of me. So while somebody was up there giving their part, I wasn't even really able to enjoy it because I was playing my poem in my head the whole time. And then, so I went, I felt immediate relief. I felt amazing after I went. And I was like, thank God this is over with. It was the best experience of my life, but it got rid of all the anxiety. And then I think you were the last one to go, right?
Yes.
Close the show. So you got up there and you gave like a little speech about how anxious you were. And I thought that was the most powerful thing that I heard that day, because it wasn't scripted. It was just you going up there and being as honest as you could possibly be. So how did you even get the idea to go up there and just start talking about how you felt now, rather than just go up and tell your story and play your song? Like, because honestly, I still use that now when I go for a talk, whether it's with NAMI or This Is My Brave or whoever it's for. I use that on days where I don't feel good. I just tell them that I'm anxious that day. And I got that from you on This Is My Brain. So thank you.
Oh. You're welcome. I'm glad my anxiety can help you.
No, well, but it was so real and so honest that I've never seen anything like that. You rarely go to a concert and then, you know, the singer gets up there and he's like, oh, I had a really bad day, and then tells you a little story about it. You know,
right.
but I wish they did. I wish more people did that, because it's so real and brutally honest. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, actually, that was quite a time. I'll tell you, the night before, the night before, I got really, really, really sick with a migraine headache, and I didn't sleep. And, I mean, I was trying to do everything. I put my head in a bathtub of ice cold water to try to, you know, freeze the migraine a little. I tried everything. I took medicine, everything. In the morning, I felt so sick to my stomach. I was very anxious too. I was having some family issues, that morning and the night before as well. So I had that kind of pressure and stress on me. I was really quite a mess, and I really didn't think that I was going to make it to do my performance. And you know, that was a really, really pivotal moment, I have to say, because and it really sucked that I was last, because the entire time. I'm sitting there and I'm like, you know, I really, there was times I really thought I was going to pass out and fall off the chair. And so I Kathleen was sitting next to me and I just turned to her because I'm thinking to myself, okay, what do I do? What do I do? I said, either I can leave the stage and go try to compose myself a little bit, or I can ask for help. So I knew that Kathleen does Reiki. And Kathleen, for me, ever since I had met her, she just was always, before I even found out she does Reiki, she, which is, you know, an energy healing of the hand. For anyone that doesn't know what Reiki is, my wife's also a Reiki master. She always, just from the very beginning, since meeting her, she has a very calming effect on a person. And, you know, even just the way, you know, her voice is, you know, the tone of her voice, the way she speaks her words, she's just a very gentle soul. Yeah. And so I said, you know, those are kind of my options. I said, so I turned to her and I was just like, you know, and I whispered like as soft as I could. And I was just like, I'm not okay. You know, and she was like, okay, what's going on? And, you know, and I mean, I showed her my hands. I was shaking like a leaf. And I said, I feel like I'm going to pass out. I think I have to leave the stage. And she put her hands on my back and her other hands on my leg. And she just leaned over to me and she said, I'm afraid that if you leave the stage, you're not going to come back. And she was right. Wow. If I left the stage, I was not going to come back to perform. And so she kept me there, and she put her hands on me, and I closed my eyes, and I tried my deep breathing. And I mean, I didn't even wear shoes out on the stage because I felt that, I mean, I was trying to pull out all the stops. You know what I mean? I was like, I'm going to get to that podium, I guess, if it kills me. But I had my bare feet. You know, because I felt like I needed to be connected. You know, I needed to be grounded. I asked Kathleen for, you know, for help, and she kept me in that chair until it was my turn. And, you know, I actually didn't have any kind of a plan to talk about the fact that I was so anxious. But when I got to the podium, I said, you know what? In my head, I was just like, what? Why are we here? We're here to talk about mental illness and how we struggle with it. You know what I mean? But like, their story and, you know, hey, yeah, I still live with it, but I'm maybe going to just show you how we can do it anyway. So I was like, and then I just opened my mouth and was like, oh my God, I'm so anxious right now. you know what I mean? And I was, and you know what? But by doing that, I honestly shocked myself. I didn't really know that was going to come out, but I just, something in me was just like, get it out right now so that you can do what you were came here to do.
And I think the rest of us behind you all looked at each other like, yes, yes, like somebody said it. Because like we're going up there and we're all reading our piece or performing our part. And then it was like, wow, it's like, that's what we all meant to say right there.
Right. Like, I mean, I was like, hey, there's probably no better time to be honest than right now.
Yeah. I mean, if I was ever producing a This Is My Brave show, I might just tell the first person just to do that, just so everybody could just take a deep breath and relax for the rest of the show.
Yep. That's actually a great idea. I got to tell you, it prepared me. It got that out enough where then I was able to compose myself and get my performance across the way, you know, that it needed to come across. And, you know, and it did. Like it really did.
It came across because you had the whole audience in tears that day with Look in the Mirror. So do you have an audio recording of Look in the Mirror?
I don't actually, and I would love to start recording my songs again in a studio. That was one of my favorite things to do with my dad, was go into the studio and record stuff. You know, so I'm hoping to get back
into doing that. And I, you know, I wasn't ready at the time to, you know, a lot of people wanted the song, you know, after the show. And I was so overwhelmed, honestly, after the show. I was so overwhelmed with just the response, you know, in general, the show and to what everybody did up there and what we were doing, you know, as a group. It yeah. was amazing. And the people that came out to support it, I mean, it was a wonderful thing. I myself, I couldn't believe that. I think I had like 15 or 20 people come into the city to see the show that day. And I was like, oh my gosh, like what, you know, like I didn't expect that. I thought, you know, okay, oh, maybe like a few people, you know, a few like my closer friends and like my family will come,
yeah.
you know, but I mean, I was really like, it was overwhelming. And, you know, I was getting a lot of attention and things were just kind of blowing up all over my social media. And I have to say, like, I went into like a cave for a pretty long time after the show.
Yeah.
I was
yeah.
very, I don't want to say, I didn't get really like depressed, but I did go down a little. I went down because it was such a high,
yeah.
you know, yeah. It was such a high that it was a little difficult, you know, a few days, like a week after to like kind of come down and be like, oh, well now what do I do with myself? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
you know, I thought I was depressed when I got out, but I think it was more like I was just digesting the whole situation because it
yeah.
was, it kind of, it took all of my focus off of the past and kind of brought it to me to focus on like the now and the future, which is something mm-hmm. I hadn't been able to do in a long time. And I think maybe I needed a couple of weeks to just like lay low and in order to shift my focus from the past to the possibility of doing more of this in the future. I think that was just like something so huge, you know, such a huge realization that it took time. You know, and that's, but yeah, I know what you mean. Cause I thought I was depressed for a few days. I was like, what's going on? Like, I don't want to do anything, but I think I was just mentally exhausted.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I know I talked to a few other, I know a few other people too, you know, from our group that, felt the same exact way. It took, you know, it took some people, you know, a little bit of time to really like just come back around and, you know, from that experience, because it was really that powerful.
Yeah.
And I really want to get that message out there, you know, about This Is My Grave. And I mean, honestly, like even throughout the when I had to come back into the city, you know, like I had to come back into the city by myself. Like I had to get on a train by myself and come into the city, you know, for the rehearsals and the, you know, and stuff. And I mean, I did it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying I wasn't anxious, because I was.
Right.
I was having anxiety attacks, you know, getting on the train. But I was using tools, you know, and I was focusing on. I find that when you focus on the reason why you're doing what you're doing, it brings the anxiety level down.
Yeah.
You know, so if I could say to myself, Danielle, why are you doing this right now? Why are you on this train right now and going into the city? Oh, well, because you're going to go share your story about living with mental illness, you know, with people, you know, that, you know, maybe don't feel as brave enough to do so. And you might be able to help some people. That's why you're doing this, to help others and to help yourself. So when I put it that way, then it would be like, oh, okay, well then that's a really good reason. And that reason trumps the anxiety in my book, you know?
Definitely.
So, I mean, I'm not saying that's the only thing. Now, these are things that I've only really been able to do within like the past, like, you know, couple years. I mean, you know, this has not always been, and it's taken a lot of work to be able to do that. But having something like This Is My Grave, you know, that you're going to, definitely helps, you know, where
yeah.
we're, you know, it absolutely was like, okay, well, this is definitely a good thing. This is such a positive thing. And I loved what you said about how, like, I can totally relate to, like, I forgot how to be positive because of just living in my anxiety, and my anxiety basically just like running the show all the time.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I totally forgot how
to be positive and what positivity even felt like or looked like, you know? And if I did feel it, it was like, oh, what is that? I don't even know if I like that. Like, it feels uncomfortable.
And right. And you have to like relearn that sometimes anxiety is just excitement, you know, like let's give it a new name, you know, let's not call it anxiety. Let's not call it fear. Let's not call it worry. Like, let's call it, I'm excited because I'm doing something fun. And it's wait a second. Oh, I'm not anxious because I'm doing something stressful. No, you're excited because you're doing something fun.
Right.
So yeah, it took me a couple years to relabel the things that I was doing as not being, driven by fear, which is most of my 20s was lived in fear. So,
yeah.
So, well, the song was amazing. And for the listeners, you can find Danielle Fiorello. If you just, I guess it's on YouTube. If you YouTube, This Is My Brave NYC and Danielle, you will get her performance of Look in the Mirror and you'll get her talk before that, which I recommend watching the whole show if you're new to This Is My Brave or if you haven't seen the New York one, because or if you have one in your hometown, just look up This Is My Brave and check out the shows because they're really doing amazing things. And as we could tell from the conversation with Danielle Fiorello Jobes today, they've done amazing things for her. I can tell you my own experience. They've done amazing things for me. And we see Jennifer Marshall of This Is My Brave doing this for everybody. And I think at this point, she's going to be in every city in America. So, so definitely look out for Danielle, thank you so much for joining us on Hysteria Radio today. For Hysteria Radio, I am Joe Fusaro. Remember to keep the radio up, to keep the hysteria down. Good night. See you next time.
Bye, Joe.
Thank you, Danielle.